Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 22nd, 2006. Our session today is entitled Faith Fundamentalisms in Three Forms, All Bad for Peace. Our presenter is Charles Lutz, session number LUC 2006-07. Let's listen in.
Logical, biblical in content in relation to the current political realities in the Holy Land. And they do it all around the U.S. and Canada, several each year. And I recommend, if you have an opportunity, to attend one of those conferences that you do so. I want to begin with a prayer, and it's a prayer that I discovered in the narthex of St. George's Cathedral in Jerusalem, the Anglican Cathedral in Jerusalem. And it really expresses, I think, what much of the Christian community in the Holy Land is asking of us. It's a prayer that is obviously addressed and meant to be prayed by internationals, not by local people in Jerusalem, but by and for international visitors to the Holy Land, pilgrims. And let me read it to you, and then I invite you to join me in this prayer. I can find it here. It's in a book that I have co-authored with a guy named Robert Smith. Robert and I did the book after we had spent some time together in the Holy Land back in 2002. The book actually appeared earlier this year. Robert is a Lutheran campus pastor at the University of Chicago. And it's available in the bookstore. And in fact, there's going to be a signing occasion tomorrow for this book and a couple of others that are being autographed, and if you're willing to purchase them, by teaching staff who are here this week. So the prayer goes this way. Let us pray, not for Arab or Jew, not for Palestinian or Israeli, but let us pray rather for ourselves, that we may not divide them in our prayers, but keep them both together in our hearts. Amen. Amen. And that's really echoed by what I've heard often from church leaders in the Holy Land, which says, we do not ask you, that is you of the Christian world outside of the Holy Land, you of the West, we do not ask that you be pro-Palestinian or pro-Israeli. We ask that you be pro-justice and pro-peace. And I think that's a good word for us as we proceed in discussing this agenda. I put on the board, and I don't know if you can all see it. It's kind of hard to read because the ink isn't very solid, isn't very strong. But I put on the board a kind of a scorecard or a roadmap of the nationalistic and faith traditions of the Holy Land. And I've got here on the left Israel and Palestine, the nationality and ethnicity in each case, and then over on this side, the faith traditions that are there. And I just very quickly want to go over that with you to give you a kind of overview of the territory and the connections between national nationalisms and faith traditions. Israel has both Jewish, that is ethnically Jewish, they define themselves ethnically as Jewish, and Arabic populations. Roughly 80% Jewish and 20% Arabic. All citizens of Israel. But not all Israelis are Jewish. The faith connections of those groups, you have Judaism. Judaism in Israel officially is only Orthodox. We know in this part of the world other Jewish tradition, other Jewish denominations, we would say, in the Christian family. What are the other traditions that are Jewish that we're aware of?
Reform.
And
conservative.
And there's even one called, I think, is it Reformist? No, not Reformist.
Reconstructionist,
yeah. But in Israel, only Orthodoxy, only Orthodox Judaism is present or is permitted or is allowed. But there's also within that a kind of group that's identified often as super Orthodox, the Hasidic tradition, the Hasidim. And they're the most radical. They are the ones who, in parts of Jerusalem, if you on the Sabbath drive down a street, they'll throw stones at your car or at your cab. They are super Orthodox about keeping the Jewish laws. And then you have a large number of Jews who identify as Jews ethnically, but who are not observant. We probably call them secular Jews. And it's important, I think, always to keep in mind that the original Zionist movement was secular. It was a secular political movement to create a Jewish homeland, what became the State of Israel. In more recent years, the Jewish political scene has been increasingly influenced by, I wouldn't say dominated by, I don't think it's a majority yet, but influenced by observant Jews, and there are Jewish religious parties that are part of the Knesset, part of the Israeli parliament. The Arabic Israelis are Muslim, nearly all, I mean a large percentage, maybe 90%, or Druze, which I don't know much about, but I know the Druze are a kind of offshoot from Islam way back, and they're not considered part of Islam today, but they're sort of related, at least historically. And then a small group of Christians, maybe 80 or 90,000 Christians out of 6.5 million Israelis, most of them living in the Galilee, around Nazareth, the Sea of Galilee, and Haifa. Palestine is entirely Arabic, ethnically. That is, all of the people, with the exception of internationals who are there working in Jerusalem and other parts of the Palestinian territories, all of the Palestinians are Arabic, ethnically. And they divide into Muslims, about 98% are Muslim, and about 2% or a little less than 2% Christian. The Christians are in four main families: Eastern Orthodox, basically Greek Orthodox. They're part of the international Greek church that is based in Greece, that is based in Athens. And for a long time, and I think even to this day, still, their leadership, their bishops in Palestine are Greeks. They're not Arabs. They're not local indigenous people, but they're from Greece. Latin Rite, or Roman Catholic, Catholics that are in fellowship with Rome, though they really aren't part of the Roman Catholic Church, but they're in fellowship with the Pope in Rome. Oriental Orthodox, Armenian, Coptic, who are really from Egypt, and a few other groups, Syrian Orthodox, and Protestant. The Protestants are by far the smallest of the four groups, only about 5 or 6,000 total. And the Protestants are largely Episcopal or Anglican and Lutheran, with a few Baptists thrown in. But that's basically it. I should say something about the Muslim community. Fatah, now these are political parties. Fatah, which was the party of the Palestine Liberation Organization, the party of Yasser Arafat, and for a long time the ruling party among the Palestinians, is secular. They are Muslims, but their political agenda is a secular one, and they wanted to create a secular Palestinian state. Hamas, on the other hand, is a religious-oriented party. They believe that in Islam you can't have separation of church and state, which is the usual Islamic position on the relationship between faith and government. They see Islam as encompassing all of life without separation, without division. And Hamas, which now has a majority in the Palestinian legislature, and whose official position forever, as long as they've existed, has been to not recognize the State of Israel and to, in fact, try to resist it and to eliminate it. Hamas bases at least part of their political ideology in the Islamic faith tradition. So there's that division within the Islamic community in Palestine. Most of the Palestinians, at least a majority, I would say, according to all the polls and all of the surveys that have been done, want a secular state, as of course do the Christians who are there. They do not want an Islamic state. Hamas has supported the creation of an Islamic state with Sharia, Islamic law, ruling governing the culture. When the Hamas victory in the legislative elections happened last January, the Lutheran pastor in Bethlehem, Mitri Raheb, whom I've gotten to know over the years because my congregation in Minneapolis has had a sister parish connection with Christmas Lutheran in Bethlehem, he said in a kind of tongue-in-cheek report on the implications of the Hamas victory, which nobody expected, by the way, including, I think, Hamas, he said, well, we can probably live with this, but we do hope that they won't introduce the Islamic requirement that women be veiled and that we close our bars. His church has a bar with their guest house serving liquor. And as you may know, in strict Islamic tradition, alcohol is forbidden.
What's the breakout between Shia and Sunni in Palestine?
Boy, I can't remember. I do know that almost all Palestinian Muslims are one or the other, but I can't remember which one it is. Does anybody know?
The Sunni is...
Sunni or Shiite?
Sunni is from Iran, right? The Sunni?
Yeah.
No,
the other way, yeah.
It's the ones that aren't in Iran.
Yeah.
Hezbollah is Shiite.
Okay.
So I assume Hamas is... Yeah.
So the Palestinians would be
Shiite.
Mainly
Shiite.
Shiite. Okay.
What do you call Palestine? Is that the West Bank as well as Gaza?
Yeah. When I say Palestine, I'm referring to what the all of the peace processes of the last couple of decades have identified as the territory which should become a viable, independent Palestinian state, with whatever variations in the final borders are established by the peace process. But basically, it's the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem.
No.
That is what Israel occupied in 1967 and has been occupying ever since.
Now, Israel has claims on some of that land.
Well, they're occupying all of that land,
yeah,
and have military control over it. But they
have
not incorporated, with the exception of East Jerusalem, they've not incorporated it into Israel proper. But they've done a lot of put a lot of settlers in the West Bank who are Israeli citizens, and that's an issue that has to be dealt with in any kind of final resolution. Any other questions or comments at this point? What I want to move to now is the increasing influence of religious extremism in all three faith traditions. Not among the Christians who live there, but among Christians in the U.S. in particular, and some other parts of the West. But let me begin with Islam. I did say that Hamas identifies very much Palestinian nationalism with Islam, with the Muslim faith tradition, and is not interested in creating a secular Palestinian state. But once actually an independent, state that they say that would include all of the Holy Land, that would replace Israel too. I think they're aware that that's not likely to happen, but that's been their stated position.
How long, Chuck, will they remain in power? I mean, is there, like in this country, is there a re-election?
There's a term. Yeah. And all of the analysis I've seen of the Hamas victory says that Hamas basically was not elected to a majority of the Palestinian legislature because of its position, because of its commitment to an Islamic state, or because of its faith orientation, but because it was seen by a lot of Palestinians as more effective in local area governments than Fatah, and as incorrupt, whereas Fatah was viewed as corrupt, the party of Arafat, and ineffective. And Hamas was very good at delivering social services to people, education and health care, etc. And therefore had a very good reputation with the voters. I should also say that within the Palestinian legislature, there are 7 Christians out of 132 seats. All of the others identify as Muslims, but 7 Christians. And some of the leading people in the Palestinian Authority over the years, and in the PLO too, have been Christians. In far beyond the proportion of their population, which is under 2%, but they have about 6% of the legislative seats. Okay, the 3 fundamentalisms. In Islam, you have the view in the teaching of all, I would think, I believe, all of the Arabic world, the teaching that God, Allah, wanted the Arabs to have all of the land, that God willed that, and that that's the intention of God, and therefore the Israeli presence is viewed as a kind of Western colonial imperialist entry into that land within the last 100 years, the Zionist movement, that it is foreign, it is alien, it is not the will of God. Now, not all Muslims translate that into a political result that says Israel has to be wiped off the map and pushed into the sea. Some do, but not all. But increasingly, the fundamentalists within Islam, in Palestine and in the neighboring states that are predominantly Muslim, make that claim that Israel has no right to be there, that God does not will it, that God gave all of this land forever to the Arabic people who are Muslim, almost entirely Muslim. It's kind of a reverse image of the extremist view among modern Zionists, not the older Zionists, who say that God gave all of this land from the river to the sea, from the Mediterranean to the Jordan River, forever to the Jews, to the descendants of the ancient Israelites, that it's part of the promise of God and all of the land is theirs, and others have no right to be there, or if they're going to be there, they have to accept second-class status. They have to accept domination by the Jewish people. You've got then a third kind of fundamentalism, which is among Christians of the West, mostly, I'm sad to say, in the United States, who are usually called Christian Zionists. Now, Christian Zionism is a little different than Jewish or Israeli Zionism, which originally was secular and was certainly intended to develop a Jewish homeland, but was not insisting that all of the land be... I mean, basically the Jews were happy with the UN partition in 1947 that divided the land roughly in half between Israelis and Palestinians. Christian Zionists, on the other hand, have a theological agenda. And their theological agenda says that at least two things, have to happen before the Lord Jesus will return. One is that the Jews alone occupy and control all of the land, from the river to the sea. And so the Christian Zionists believe that it's God's will, that Israel expand to include the entire territory from the river to the Jordan to the Mediterranean, and that the Palestinians get out, that they be ethnically cleansed. The other thing that the Christian Zionists argue is that the temple has to be rebuilt, what would be in effect the third temple on the site of the original Solomon Temple and the second temple that was destroyed by the Romans in 70 AD. And what's on that site today, you know? The Dome of the Rock, a Muslim holy shrine that's been there for about 1,300 years. And then there will be a rule of Christ on earth, and then there will be a final cataclysmic battle called Armageddon, which happens at Megiddo up in the north of Israel near Nazareth. And then there will be a final decision for what happens to everybody. Everybody either becomes converted to Christ and is saved or is annihilated. That's the scenario of the Christian Zionists. They have it for their own, they have it for their own end times reason. And by the way, Christian Zionism's ideology is pretty well spelled out in the Left Behind novels. If you know the Left Behind novels. And the best book, I think, to deal with that and to say it's not biblical and to explain what the biblical prophetic teachings really are all about is Barbara Rossing's The Rapture Exposed. Barbara is an ELCA theologian teaching at Chicago, the Theological School in Chicago, and is a former village pastor here at Holden. So you've got this convergence of Christian Zionists who often or regularly, routinely over the years have organized group visits to the Holy Land, but they never visit with the local Christians because they think the indigenous Christians, both in Israel and Palestine, are not authentic theologically or politically. But they do meet with the Israeli right-wing groups who have a similar political objective, which is to have all of the land under the state of Israel.
Is Bush one of those?
Well, there are people who say that Bush is influenced more in the U.S. policy with regard to Israel and Palestine by the Christian right, the Christian, and many of them are Christian Zionists in the U.S., than by the Jewish lobby in the U.S. But the two often go together. I distributed earlier this week an article by Sarah Posner, who writes for the American Prospect magazine, and she talks about the influence of the Christian right, and particularly a pastor in Texas, San Antonio, named John Hagee, who's a televangelist. Don't know if you've ever seen him. But he is one who says very openly that he thinks it is the will of God that the Palestinians be moved out of the Holy Land and that the entire land become part of the State of Israel. And that he was once asked, we quote him in this book, he was once asked if his raising money to support Israeli settlers in the West Bank might be viewed as a violation of U.S. policy. Because U.S. policy over the years has said that the settlements shouldn't be done, and he said, "Well, I don't care. I follow the Bible. I don't follow the U.S. State Department with what I do, and the Bible tells me that that's what we should be about is settling Jews on the Palestinian territory."
Chuck?
Yeah,
it's pretty clear for most of us, I think, where two of these fundamentalisms get their sacred texts to draw their theology from. But it's not clear to me where the Muslims get their, what sacred texts are they drawing?
Well, they're basing it on their, I think, their reading of the Quran.
Any particular part? Or?
I don't know. I'm not familiar enough with that to know exactly where it comes from in the Quran. But I know that the Quran talks about the land of the people of God, meaning the Muslim people, and it includes all of that territory, all of the area that we think of as not just Arabic, but wherever Islam is, and not all Muslims are Arabic. It's beyond that, and Jerusalem is mentioned regularly in the Quran as a holy city. It's called in Arabic Al-Quds, which just means the holy, meaning the holy place, the holy site. It's one of the three holy places of Islam, along with Medina and Mecca. But they view that land much in the same way that some Jews, and I think some Christians do, as a special place, special because of the activity of God there, special because it's in some sense holy, that the rest of the world isn't. The irony of it is, as James Carroll, a Catholic writer, has said, Jerusalem, throughout history, for many millennia, has become the epicenter of God-sponsored violence. Not a city of peace, you know, not he's not blaming God for it. He's saying people in the name of God have used Jerusalem as a center for violence. And that continues to this day. Let's see, what else do we want to do before we go to the video?
Chuck, I'd ask earlier about Hamas.
Hamas.
How long their term is? Because if they have a certain period of time that they're in office, and then the people get frustrated with them and vote them out, then hopefully that'll allow some reconciliation. Is that a naive hope?
The analysis that I've read is, in fact, this really was being said almost immediately after the Hamas victory in January, that because it was truly an open and fair election, and everybody agrees that it was really the will of the people being expressed. Jimmy Carter was there as one of the international observers, and he said that too. The expectation was that the next time around, if Hamas did not deliver any progress toward peace with Israel, any progress toward the creation of an independent Israeli or Palestinian state, that people wouldn't support them at the next election. And I think it's 3 years. I think it's a 3-year term, but I'm not sure of that. I just want to say one more thing about the role of the tiny Christian minority in the Holy Land. This is a quote from a writer and observer named William Dalrymple, who's a Brit. He has written about and has expressed concern about the fact that a steady immigrant stream of both Christian and Jewish moderates. Not many Muslims have been emigrating, but Christians and Jews in Israel have been emigrating, which continues to drain both Palestine and Israel to escape the rival fanaticisms of the conflict, he says, possibly creating a situation down the road in which only the fundamentalist Israeli settlers will be left to confront their opposite numbers in Palestinian Hamas. And, you know, he regrets that. He thinks that's a regrettable development. And then he says, the Christian Arabs have always protected the Arab world from the extremes of political Islam. Since the 19th century, they have taken a vital part in defining a secular Arab identity. If the Christians continue to emigrate, the Arabs will find it much harder to defend themselves against radical Islamism. And a similar word comes from Charles Sennett, who was the longtime Boston Globe reporter, bureau chief in Jerusalem. And before he left there in the year 2000, he published a book called The Body and the Blood. And it's a look at the continuing conflict between Israeli Jews and Arabs through the lenses of the Christians who are there. And he goes just on and on about how the Christian community, this tiny minority, sees it and what they're doing about it. And he says this, the Christian presence in the Holy Land is a potentially important, possibly essential voice in the dialogue for peace. You know, remember, it's only 1.5% of the total 10 million people who live there who are Christian. And yet, he says, a possibly essential voice. But it is a voice that has been reduced to a hoarse whisper. Historically, Christianity has provided a kind of leavening in the Middle East, a small but necessary ingredient acting as a buffer between the Arab world's broad Islamic resurgence and the strands within Israel of a rising ultra-nationalist brand of Judaism. These two fundamentalist movements, which have fused religion with nationalism, increasingly cast the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in religious terms. If the Christians disappear, the Middle East will become that much more vulnerable to this embittered dichotomy. And I think the way he writes about it is exactly the way the Christians who are there see themselves, see their role as a necessary presence between the increasingly fundamentalist extremists of both Islam and Judaism. And that's what God is calling them to do and calling them to stay there. In the face of an increasingly departing Christian population. They've been leaving in disproportionate numbers, and I think it's basically because they see no, many of them see no hope, so see no future. By the way, tonight after Vespers, we're going to have a forum on the question, is there any hope? And we're going to talk about that. Some of us, well, we're going to have all of you talk about that, because forums aren't lectures, but discussions. But four of us who have spent significant amount of time there are going to kick it off and then and say what we see as signs of hope there. There's another significant piece that we really don't have time to talk much about, but let me just flag it, and that is the very important and, I would say, historically crucial presence of the international Christian community, the presence of the global church, which goes back many, many centuries, of course, really to the time of Constantine in the Roman Empire. But internationals have been there working and serving and ministering to people and planting churches in some cases. The Germans were there in the 19th century, German Lutherans, and that's why there's a Palestinian Lutheran church today. But they haven't done only the traditional evangelistic work or missionary work in the sense of bringing people to faith in Christ. They've been for a long time mainstays of the humanitarian service operation in that land. Education, schools, medicine, hospitals. The Lutherans to this day are operating a major hospital on the Mount of Olives called Augusta Victoria. The Lutherans are also supporting a vocational training school for Palestinians in the Jerusalem area and many other kinds of ministries. And there are people who go there to, some spend a lifetime of service in that part of the world. Others go for a shorter period. Some go for just a couple of years. And some go as peacemakers. We're going to have Heidi Schramm with us in the forum talking about her experience as a Christian peacemaker in the West Bank. And that's a fairly recent development. But there are internationals, non-Israeli, non-Palestinian Christians who come there and work with the people. And increasingly, they come to work in the peace process to try to help build peace between Israelis and Palestinians. Let me turn on the video now. And if we have time at the end of the video, we can do a little discussion of it. But it runs about 24 minutes, and that'll pretty much take us to 7:30. Sabil is the Arabic word for the way, and it's an organization of Palestinian Christians, which they call a liberation theology movement.
May the God of the home hold you, show you the violence Palestinians endure even today. The Israeli Defense Forces interrupt a Palestinian family enjoying friends in their garden. Other than running inside, these people have no viable recourse when attacks such as this occur, and this is one of them.
The prophet Isaiah was very concerned about what was happening in his own day. And he said, the way of peace they do not know. There is no justice in their path. So he connected peace with justice. And that is very important. That's exactly what we at Sabil connect. When we talk about peace, we are talking about justice.
And justice is part of Christianity, part of Judaism, part of Islam. And we really, as humans, we have to work hard to get justice.
Sabil is a Palestinian Christian organization started in Jerusalem by a group of Palestinian Christians, mainly lay people, very strong women's leadership at Sabil. And we started to make the gospel relevant to Palestinian Christians. We are also working with Christian-Muslim relations in Jerusalem and in other parts of the country. And we also work on justice and peace.
I think people who are for justice and human rights and peace are on the same side. Naeem and I aren't in any way on opposite sides. The ones that are on the other side from me are the ones that are encouraging conflict and domination and occupation and militarism.
I think the battle is really here. Yes, the Palestinians can develop a strategy that needs to be done, and I totally agree with Jeff that there have been some serious failings in that regard. I think there are other strategies like nonviolent resistance that need to be considered, if not adopted. But the battle is really here because there's a power dynamic going on, and the only way to actually balance out that imbalance of power between a very strong Israel and a very weak Palestinian Authority is to have pressure from the outside on Israel. It's not going to happen through negotiations. Now, that might come as a surprise coming from someone like myself who's an advisor, or used to be an advisor to the negotiations team, but it's precisely because I was an advisor that I realized that negotiations between a weak party and a strong party cannot yield any sort of fair result. And I think we saw that over 10 years of negotiations after Oslo.
The Israeli occupation must come to an end. When I talk about the occupation, I am talking about these areas. Gaza, the West Bank, East Jerusalem. A Palestinian state must be established. And the Palestinian state must be viable, sovereign, and independent, not under the domination of Israel. And Israel must recognize the territorial integrity of the Palestinian state. Palestinians and the Arab states must recognize and accept the state of Israel. So recognition and acceptance of the state of Israel is essential for peace. The government of Israel must admit the injustice it has inflicted on the Palestinians and accept its responsibility in making amends.
Israel right now is in control of the Gazan aquifer, the only source of water for Gaza. When the settlers were living in Gaza, the 7,000 settlers compared to 1.3 million Palestinians were using about three-fourths of the water from the Gazan aquifer, which means a huge tragedy for the Gazans. There's discussion about selling water to the Gaza, about 3 shekels a bottle of water. And I tell you, $2, an average person in Gaza living under $2 a day will not afford water.
You know, as a result of the creation of the State of Israel, 750,000 Palestinians were driven out of their homes. Some fled. None of us was able to go back home. My family was driven out by force at gunpoint. I was a boy at the time, and I remember that if we do not leave our homes and get out of our town, that they will kill us. And what happened to me happened to 750,000 Palestinians. In order to prevent the Palestinian refugees from returning to their homes, they bulldozed over 500 destroyed villages throughout the area that became Israel. So today, the 750,000 Palestinian refugees are over 4 million. So the fifth point, we have to address the Palestinian refugee issue justly. I want, on one hand, to be sensitive to Israeli needs, but I want also a just solution to the Palestinian refugees.
The world thinks that Israel's biggest enemy is terror, when in fact it is a demographic war that Israel is fighting and continues to create new measures on the ground in order to contain the Palestinians from growing to larger numbers that they can no longer handle.
According to international law, all the settlements built by Israel on occupied Palestinian land are illegal. Sabin suggests that instead of dismantling the settlements, they must become an integral part of the Palestinian state, and they would form the new towns for the returning Palestinian refugees. But also we say that if Jewish settlers want to live in Palestine on those settlements, the Palestinians should welcome them. But the settlers would have to become Palestinian citizens. So by doing so, we are redeeming the settlements. So the sixth point is we must address the settlement issue, and we cannot accept the settlements to stay where they are or to become part of Israel.
There was one part of the Zionist ideology that I never ever accepted, that I never understood, and that I think has ruined everything. And that's the idea of exclusivity.
There is no way around this. No Palestinian, Muslim or Christian, would accept to see Jerusalem under the exclusive sovereignty of Israel. Religiously, my friends, the city is equally holy to the three religions, and politically it can be shared capital for both the Palestinian as well as the Israeli state. If this does not happen, the conflict would only be postponed, but never solved.
Physically, psychologically, and socioeconomically, and demographically, Jerusalem has been divided and subjugated beyond its 1967 occupation. Settlements are expanding in and around Jerusalem. There are about 10 settlements in Jerusalem, about 7,000 settlers. The apartheid rule has successfully separated the city from its West Bank hinterland, and some of its own communities are no longer contiguous. And I even heard in July that Jerusalemites, Palestinian Jerusalemites, will be issued permits now to be able to access the West Bank or Ramallah. The eastern part of Jerusalem is strangled and crumbling, denied any semblance of equality in the simplest way, such as municipal services. Meanwhile, unemployment and poverty is rising, along with taxation, leaving more and more people completely dependent on social security from Israel. And I'm a live example of those who cannot find jobs in Jerusalem. And I can't obviously find jobs in the West Bank or future mini state because I can't access them.
Beginning of the second intifada, I read in the news that a woman had to give birth at the checkpoint. I was absolutely shattered and deeply ashamed to hear that things like this have to happen under my name. To fight anti-Semitism means to accept universally valid moral values. And one of these obligations is to speak out, not to remain silent when we detect injustice in our surroundings. In the face of injustice and oppression, a moral person must not close its eyes and keep silent. And since I live 20 minutes from the place where daily and hourly human rights violations are committed, I must not remain silent. I found a couple of women, and we were very few, and we founded a group which is called Mahzon Watch, which is a connection between Hebrew and English name. Mahzon means checkpoint, the checkpoint watch women. Today we are 500 women all over the all over Israel and the West Bank, and we monitor 25 checkpoints twice daily, every day in the week.
Sabir today is promoting the whole issue of confederation, and we believe that this is possible. We need Israel. Israel can help us. Our country has been devastated by the occupation. And so we're working for two states, but linked together in a dynamic, creative relationship so that we can become interdependent on each other. This, we believe, is essential to the future of peace in our area.
And that leads me to the rebirth of the prophetic and truth-telling Jews of Conscience 2000 to the present. Solidarity with the Palestinian people as a solidarity with Jewish history, recognizing the implications of Israeli power, control from Tel Aviv to the Jordan River, which is what it is. Jerusalem as the broken middle of Israel-Palestine, where two broken peoples could meet and begin again. And revolutionary forgiveness. That is a forgiveness that is based in justice, where the assault of one against the other is then taken into a new place when justice is the path, and where an injury against one ultimately becomes an injury against the other.
We must build a culture of peace. We must implement an educational program for peace in Israel and in Palestine. We need to invent a culture of peace and nonviolence. It must be active for the sake of all of our children who have been brought up on violence. The conflict and the interest in nonviolence have been tremendous in the Palestinians, with the Palestinians. Many, many times you don't see it, you don't hear about it, because none is killed in the action of the Palestinians. And it's our hope that every village in Palestine can be trained in nonviolence. It's a request coming from them. And the second request, we hope strongly that that request also will come from refugee camps. My final point for the Sabir of peace: we must build democracy in our area. We must have a society where religion is separated from the state. One of the greatest threats back home is coming from the extremist, religious extremists of both sides. We have Palestinian extremists and Israel has Israeli extremists. Israel today brags of its democracy, but its full democratic benefits are largely limited to its Jewish citizens. In Israel today, there are about 1.3 million Palestinians who are Israeli citizens, and they are discriminated against because they are not Jewish. I am one of those because I hold an Israeli citizenship. And many people inside Israel today are working against discrimination of Arab, Palestinian, Israelis. So that we will have full democracy in Israel itself for all of its citizens. But the same needs to apply to the Palestinians. We still don't have a state, but we are working, and I hope it will happen, that the Palestinian state will have to be democratic for all of its citizens, not only for Muslims, but also for Christians. We must work to build a society that respects religion and religious freedom, but consigns it to the private sector. We must work hard to create respect, understanding, and acceptance among the people of different religious backgrounds. The beauty of both Palestinian and Israeli societies is its multicultural, multi-religious, and multi-ethnic backgrounds. We must keep the mosaic. We must work for a non-racial and non-sexist society. I believe these 10 points that I have outlined for you make up the Sabil of peace. I commend it to you. I ask you, my friends, to pray for us. I ask you to join us so that we can achieve the Sabil of peace. Remember that you are truly a child of God when you are active in peacemaking.
There's a postscript by an American Jewish theologian, Mark Ellis, on how American Christians and American Jews need to talk with each other about the reality of Israel and the conflict. And it's a very important message, I think, from him. Minnesota native, graduate of McAllister College in St. Paul, now an Israeli citizen.
To be Jewish and to have suffering is not only to protect Jews against suffering and violence, yes, but to protect everyone against it, including when Jews are doing it. You see, we just haven't woken up, that is, the Constantinian Jewish establishment, to the fact that when we get power, we do just about everything that has been done to us. Progressive Jews have basically, over the last 20 years, been against any question of political action or economic action vis-a-vis Israel. The Quakers have made a lifetime of bringing these Jews around. But they've actually held back the discussion by setting parameters of debate, which means that Palestinians cannot have their own voice. Divestment, U.S. aid to Israel, military support for Israel, etc., are concrete ways of addressing Israeli power. Now, but too late, or very late, Christian denominations are coming out one by one for aspects of divestment. They're being hit by Constantinian Judaism. And what do those Christians do? They're very nervous. Christians don't know how to stand up to Jews when Jews are wrong. The Jews have no problem standing up to Christians when we think Christians are wrong. What is it about Christians? What is it about Christianity? Well, part of it's the history. Part of it is your history. Yeah, the big part of it. But you are not a friend of the Jewish people if you go running the call from Jewish power. And you make Jews of conscience life much more difficult. You want to be in solidarity with the Jewish people? I'm all for it. Be in solidarity with Jews of conscience in America and in Israel. You are not a friend of the Jewish people if you are a friend of Constantinian Judaism.
Underscore from this is the fact that within Israel and to some extent also within the American Jewish community, there are many people and many groups working for Palestinian rights. Jeff Helper, the guy I said was from Minnesota, is one example of that. He's formed the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, trying to stop his own government, the Israeli government, from demolishing Palestinian homes in order to build the wall, in order to put settlers on that land for whatever reason. And when his group fails to stop the demolition, they help Palestinians to rebuild. He is an example of an Israeli who's committed to working for justice and human rights for the Palestinians. He's representing a minority within Israel, but he is there. There are other groups. There's a group called Rabbis for Human Rights that works with Palestinian villagers harvesting olives and doing other things in the shadow of Israeli settlements who are harassing the Palestinian villagers in the West Bank. We need to be aware of that because that doesn't get much attention in our media. And it's also not often reported in our media that there are American Jewish groups working for the rights of Palestinians and for a just peace between Israel and Palestine. And not just the Jewish lobby that is always pressing for defense of Israel and its behavior. So we've got a few minutes if we want to talk about any of what you've seen. Yes?
I was just wondering, I didn't see all of it, but does our World Council of Churches have any involvement with this or at all?
The World Council of Churches has developed a program with the Palestinian churches, Palestinian Christians, of what is called ecumenical accompaniment. People are recruited from around the world, church folk, to go and spend 3 months as an ecumenical accompanier, as a presence, again, as very much what the Christian peacemaker teams do, to be a kind of buffer between hostile Israeli settlers and Palestinian villagers in the West Bank. And there are a couple of those people that I know who have come from Minnesota to do that. And they've come from other parts of the U.S. as well. And that's a program that might be of interest to some of you. The World Council of Churches has also recently spoken in support of and asked its member churches to do economic pressures. Not just divestment, but also positive investment in U.S. companies with their pension money and other investments. U.S. companies that are actively engaged in helping to build the Palestinian economy, helping to support economic growth within the Palestinian territories. And there are, you know, other ways, and we'll talk about that tomorrow. What can we do with our money power to be helpful in the quest for peace? There was somebody back here. Yes.
Your presentation is a very helpful schematic on the forces at play. But you did mention the Hezbollah. Could you clarify how that fits into all this?
Well, Hezbollah is a group within Lebanon, but it's you know, right on the border of Israel, border of Galilee, and I think it's pretty clear, identifies with the Palestinian cause, though Hezbollah would be more like the Hamas view that Israel has no right to exist. Hezbollah recently, as I think you're all aware, captured an Israeli a pair of Israeli soldiers and said they wanted to arrange a prisoner exchange, returning those two soldiers for a large number of Arabs, including some Lebanese, who are held in Israeli prisons. And that led them to fighting back and forth and a lot of killing and a lot of destruction of Lebanese infrastructure. And they're now at a ceasefire, and there's going to be an international force brought in, I believe, under UN sponsorship, to try to disarm Hezbollah and try to occupy that southern Lebanon territory where Hezbollah has been active. Hezbollah, like Hamas, is a political party. It's a part of the Lebanese government. It doesn't have a majority, but it has a significant presence in the Lebanese government. There was somebody back here. Yeah.
Well, there's two things. One thing, could you define what Mark Ellis called Constantine Jew?
Oh, yeah. Constantinian Judaism is his way of drawing a parallel for the present expression of Jewish power or his power of a Jewish nationalism in the form of the State of Israel. First time that's been true, that the Jews have had political power on their own land for, what, almost 2,000 years, I guess. Well, even longer ago than that. The Jews have, most of their history, have lived under occupation or domination by somebody else. He's drawing a parallel to that reality, where he says the people who have been often oppressed and persecuted, when they have power, do the same thing to others. Mm-hmm. And that's what he says happening. He's drawing a parallel with that and the Christian Constantinianism, which happened when Christianity became the official religion of the Roman Empire, and when Christendom emerged. You know, the linking of Christianity with state power.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing was something that hasn't been mentioned, and I don't even know if I should mention it, but it's in the media all the time, is the suicide bombings.
Uh-huh.
That we hear about so much here, and don't hear, you know, like what we've learned tonight, what's going on in Palestine.
Yeah, it was in the video, a brief mention of the terrorism that the Israelis fear. They feel insecure because of the attacks on mm-hmm. Israeli, mostly civilians, by Palestinian terrorists. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a part of the reality.
That certainly isn't helping the Palestinian cause.
I don't think it does. No. And most Palestinians, I think, would agree that it doesn't.
A question. There is, you know, the elephant in the living room, which is that the demographic bomb mm-hmm. that is there, mm-hmm. that if Israel does nothing except contain Jerusalem within a generation or two, the Arabs in Jerusalem that are Israeli citizens will outnumber the Jews.
I don't think that's true in Jerusalem alone. If Israel were to incorporate into the State of Israel with full citizenship rights all of the people between the river and the sea, a little over 10 million, even now there would be a majority who are non-Jewish. And of course that's not something Israel will do, because they want to remain a Jewish state. They want to have a Jewish majority. There are even some Israelis who are concerned about the fact that 20% of the Israeli citizenry now is non-Jewish, and growing faster than the Jewish population. So yeah, that's the demographic bomb that's referred to, and that's undoubtedly the main reason why is most historically most winning parties in wars that have occupied another people's territory have incorporated that territory into their own state and let the people thereof participate as citizens of that entity, that governmental entity. Israel will not do that, because then there would be a minority
who were Jewish. And so what do you do? What do you do then with the land? Well, it's often been observed that Israel would really like to keep the land, but without the people of the land. And Ariel Sharon, when he was prime minister, often said, the Palestinians already have their state. It's called Jordan. Let them go there. Let them emigrate to Jordan. Well, about 1 million Palestinians have, and they are now citizens of the Kingdom of Jordan. But the rest, I think, will not want to do that. We probably need to call it here. One more.
Oh, I'm sorry. It sounds like I'm getting into your next time to get together with us, but when you've got almost what appears to be an irreconcilable position on the part of the Israelis, and then you've got the Hamas government in Palestine, which is, appears to be irreconcilable with the existence of the Jewish state, how do you negotiate with two parties like that?
Well, the Hamas leadership has said, and the president of the Palestinian Authority is not Hamas. He's Mahmoud Abbas, who's from Fatah, and with whom both the Israeli Prime Minister Olmert and George W. Bush have met. They would not meet with Arafat, but they have met with him. But Hamas has said, it's the legislative branch, it has the majority, it's the governing authority there. They've said that they are willing to sit down and meet with the Israelis and with the U.S. government representatives to talk about a peace process. But so far, the U.S. government and the Israeli government have said they will not meet with Hamas. They're not meet with a government that's led by Hamas. So I don't know where that's going to go. It may have to wait for another change in government, both in the U.S. and in Israel, before that will happen. But you're right. There's nothing happening today in the peace negotiations. They're not talking to each other, and they really haven't been since the end of the Clinton administration in 2001. We will be back here after Vespers, for those who want to continue the conversation, in a forum under the question, is there any hope? And we're going to try to lift up some signs of hope, which are, frankly, hard to find. But thank you.